Hello, and welcome to Leading in Extreme Circumstances, Managing Today, Preparing for the New Normal Afterwards. Like so many of the insights materials that we create, our goal here is to provide you with hopefully some new ideas you haven't heard anywhere else. And there's always a risk that some of those ideas are pretty much confirmatory, but we hope to at least give you something to think about as you confront very challenging situations in running customer experience programs. The agenda we'll cover here today really takes three parts. We're going to, first of all, talk a bit about the medium we're using here very quickly, and then we're going to move straight into a framework that might help you think about how you approach these kinds of problems. So as problems change, you take some basic core ideas away with you that might enable you to think differently. And then finally, we're going to frame things in terms of three specific phases over time that we think is a really useful way to consider the types of actions you want to take. Of course, throughout this, we're also trying to bring this down to very practical steps you can take around executing your current program or your plans for future programs. So let's get stuck in. We designed this particular information to be best consumed in the form of either a podcast or a video. So even though there are slides you can download, they're not going to make quite as much sense if you don't have the accompanying soundtrack. Let's get into frameworks then. One of the core frameworks that we refer to constantly is this idea that companies that perform really well in general around customer experience and indeed financial performance associated with customer experience manage to achieve an underlying alignment between three important groups, that being the shareholders, customers, and employees. And the degree of alignment around these three groups tends to be very indicative of future profitability. If all three groups are well aligned around what it means to be successful, and the company can perform at levels, realize the expectations of these three groups, then that tends to lead to great deals of profitability and outperformance in competitive markets. It's interesting that in an era when there's a vigorous discussion around the merits of stakeholder capitalism, the shareholders should not necessarily be paramount. The irony is that for most companies that are achieving high performance in both earnings growth and also growth in general, they've already accomplished something along similar lines. They already see their employees as highly engaged in their business. They already have high NPS reflecting customer alignment. And not surprisingly, that leads to high shareholder returns. But this framework is what gets out of whack in the event of some kind of change in circumstances. In the event of a major recession or a major crisis, typically the first thing you notice is that shareholder performance is significantly damaged. The second thing you notice is that employees start to suffer potential losses, income, and jobs, and simultaneously customers tend to lose alignment with the company. So their expectations change, and accordingly they're less in sync with what the company is trying to do. Companies then in that situation should be seeking some form of new equilibrium. And that equilibrium is going to change as you move through different phases, as we'll discuss. But what the smart companies do is anticipate what that new equilibrium looks like, sets new expectations both for shareholders, employees, and customers, and then rapidly transitions to the future state. This is the inherent foundation of all good customer experience strategy. A transition from current state to a future stable and profitable balance. We like to look at the crisis response through three particular phases. We think this is a useful way to understand how you tackle what could be quite a daunting task. The first phase we think of as being characterized by extreme volatility, and the whole purpose of the first phase is to try and mitigate the impact of that volatility. Recognize different rules apply, short-term execution doesn't necessarily reflect long-term goals, and for many businesses, the first priority becomes survival or damage limitation. But the second priority, close behind that, is to build a strategy for the next phase. And the second phase, you can think of as a transition into the new normal, which can often be done through a series of iterations rather than one particular move. Clearly, you have to have a clear sense of what the new normal is going to be, and that becomes only visible over time. So you're not necessarily going to get to the perfect place immediately, but you can get to the new normal by looking at iterative improvements in your operations, understanding what the data is telling you about your customers, and continuing until you can reasonably achieve a steady state again. To conclude, we're going to overcome some of our short-term biases by imagining what we would want to say to ourselves with the benefit of 10 years of reflection and hindsight about our performance during this time period. One other note about phases is that there's really no abrupt shift between these phases. In fact, it's hard to spot as these phases change, except in hindsight. It's a bit like calling the bottom in the stock market or calling the top. After it's happened, it's pretty easy to spot, but at the time, it's pretty tricky. So let's talk about the first phase, which is characterized by extreme volatility. Well, what's going on? Well, society in general, painfully aware of transitions taking place, typically doesn't know the duration, doesn't know how things are going to end up. All existing rules of engagement with customers are upended to some degree, with new rules being unclear. Individuals and businesses tend to compress time horizons. And as we often witness, profitability for businesses typically drop, and in some forms drop quite dramatically, which leads companies to start to make efforts to control costs, sometimes out of necessity, sometimes out of trying to preserve the financial performance of the business. And examples of this occurred as far back as 1939 with the Second World War, but also more recently in 2008 and today in 2020. So expectations are changing amongst the three groups. Shareholders are more willing to accept poor performance. As any CFO will tell you, it's a lot easier to explain poor performance to shareholders at a time when the stock market is performing poorly than it is when it's performing well. And a lot of CFOs will use this as air cover to actually set expectations even lower than is realistic so that they can build from a low base. Employees, on the other hand, tend to focus on more basic requirements, job security, safety, health. And customers, the group perhaps in this context we're most interested in, their expectations change very rapidly. They don't form a steady picture for some time. In other words, your customers really aren't who they were right before all this started. First of all, it's really nothing about you anymore. Customers tend to focus on their most immediate and basic needs, and they really don't care as much about brands and vendors. The whole premise of customer feedback is the idea that your customers respect your right to make a profit, they're interested in your business, and they're interested in how they can help you grow your business. Well, none of that applies in times of extreme volatility. The context for customers is very unique and is very fluid, and your position in that hierarchy of importance for them drops substantially. Finally, another observation would be that in most instances, business to business tends to lose ground to business consumer products. I certainly care more about myself, my family, than I do about the business I serve or the other businesses that serve me. Products and services are going to get judged now against very different sets of expectations. The relative importance of those journey elements that you've been modeling over the years and understanding what matters and what doesn't and to what degree, well, all that gets remixed. A lot of moral judgments start to mix with economic judgments in very different ways. Things that didn't matter in the equation of how customers evaluated you matters a heck of a lot more in these circumstances. We also worth noting that because experience tends to be remembered during heightened stress periods, all your thinking around what types of events create the most memorable experiences start to both change and get accentuated. If you remember the peak end rule, which is that generally people remember the high point of any experience and the last thing that happened in any experience, well, that's an example of psychologically how we prioritize. But that kind of thinking gets applied in extremes when it comes to heightened stress periods amongst your customers. It's also worth remembering the quote from Daniel Kahneman that an experience is not really effective unless it's remembered. Well, right now, customers are more likely to remember you. One of the old tropes people like to say is that the Chinese symbol for crisis is a combination of danger and opportunity. Probably rather ironic in the situation in 2020. But opportunity can be very dangerous. What's the distinction between pursuing opportunities in crisis or war profiteering? One person's view of good business practice can be quite different from another. And you want to be very cautious about how you proceed to engage in good business practice. We should remember that the memory of experience is not necessarily representative of the experience itself. People don't remember all aspects of experience. They are very subjective in how they interpret it. Also worth remembering that under stressful conditions, they may remember these experiences or feel them a lot more acutely. For most companies, an adjustment speed becomes very, very important because companies that are trying to execute these kind of changes in policies are facing a real dilemma. Too slow to execute and customers feel like you're not adapting quickly enough. Too quickly and you can make mistakes. One of my favorite principles is that of Hanlon's razor. If you're not familiar with it, it goes something like this. Never assume malice, something that could be explained by simple incompetency. Well, for customers in extreme stress situations or in extremely volatile phase, that rule kind of gets suspended and people assume malice. So you have to be very careful in striking the right balance of making adjustments that are both reasonable, quick enough, but also not rushing to make changes that are going to look out of sync in the marketplace. To sum all this up, when you're facing this dilemma, what we would always suggest is that the foundational principle to observe is that customers want to hear, they want to observe in your behavior, and they want to believe it's true of your organization, the concept that we're all in this together. On a very practical basis, what happens to Net Promoter Score in this environment? Well, first of all, let's remember, NPS is a metric designed to somewhat capture extremes. It picks up promoters and detractors and weights them in the equation. It sort of ignores passives. You are being measured against a different set of expectations, and NPS, whether someone's a promoter or a detractor, is all relative to expectations. So the data is going to change. Furthermore, it's going to be incomparable with prior and potentially future sets of data because expectations are so volatile. So data going up, going down, directional change in general, isn't necessarily particularly useful direction. We can also expect response rates to drop. As we say, customer feedback is the gift of their time to you. They now have more important things. Responses amongst passives probably drop even more. Doesn't necessarily affect NPS, but does affect the kinds of mix which you should be looking at to understand whether you have more passives, promoters, or detractors. So data biases the extremes, affects the mix, not necessarily the score. Bear in mind the summary of this. Customer expectations are in flux. They've yet to stabilize. So NPS is pretty fluid. With that in mind, it's quite possible that relationship surveys aren't terribly useful for you right now in terms of their data content. Now, that doesn't mean they might not prove valuable as some form of signaling or communication tool, but you need to understand the reason you're doing it. Your data is going to look quite out of sync with prior data. You're not going to be able to use it for any of the typical useful purposes you have, trending over time, understanding change. You certainly don't want to be thinking about using it for anything tied to compensation or incentive behavior. But on the other hand, surveys can be an important communication tool. So what should you be doing in this situation? At the risk of stating the obvious, recognize that your circumstances have changed. First of all, stop. Think very carefully about the next moves before you make them. Most major mistakes come from continuing if nothing has happened at all. From your customer's perspective, something is happening, and so they expect you to adjust accordingly, and they can be quite unforgiving if they perceive you're not. But the second major source of mistakes is creating additional damage through reacting in the wrong way. Watching for wheels in motion that you already have in your business could potentially send the wrong signal to customers. Surveys are communication. At the best of time, it's a conversation with the customer. The customer donates their time to you in the interest of a relationship that has value to them. When the volatility is existence, that compact, that agreement is basically broken. But it's also important to understand that surveys are really perceived by customers in many ways as just another form of marketing communication. Now, it might be the case that you have better intentions than trying to push sales of your product, but are you sure that your customer can tell the difference? Think carefully about what the message you want to send. Change your message to fit the context in which the customer reads it. Even if you're going to send surveys to customers, the introduction, the setup, needs to be very appropriate for the circumstances. It needs to send a message customers can really identify with, and they understand why you're asking them for their time, what you intend to do with that information, and you demonstrate that you understand the situation that they face themselves with. As relevant also for this, we want to understand that the employee customer experience DNA that we have, that we like to think of, are our teams customer-centric, well, that's changed as well. In any sort of crisis situation, your organization is less well-equipped to deal with customers. They're certainly less well-equipped to deal with stressful situations with customers. Your employees have their own issues. So essentially, both the customers and employees exist in a highly triggered state where they can be quite stressful. Putting them together without the right degree of training can be a very volatile combination. So clearly there are reasons your employees need to interact with customers, but now isn't the time to be adding beyond those essential interactions they have to do. In particular, when we think about closing the loop, are you sure that your team is trained to be able to execute that kind of conversation in the new context? Is the reality of their personal circumstances sufficiently stable? Is the cost benefit here worthwhile? And in this phase, I think many of you will find the answer is no, and taking no action is the lowest risk of all. which ironically means that if you're not going to follow up on actions with customers, is it worth even asking transactional questions? So as we summarize this first phase, a few questions you might want to ask yourself. How will your CX measure be impacted? Should you continue to measure at all? Are customers simply too impacted to respond? Or are you just going to create a series of outliers which renders the data value of it essentially zero? Perhaps most importantly, should your survey communication strategy shift to focus on the moment we're in? Let's talk about the second phase of this transition to the state we'll call the new normal. Warren Buffett's oft-quoted quip that only when the tide goes out do you know who's swimming naked is possibly a good place to start when thinking about the next phase. Here is a situation where companies that were in good health with their customers tend to be in a better position than those who weren't, those who have good balance sheets clearly in a better position than those that don't, and so forth and so on. So the situation created by a crisis tends to reveal the underlying health of businesses. Volatility is typically reduced now at this point because we're starting to get to a level of new stability and the rules of the game are starting to become more apparent. We may not like them. They may be considerably less attractive than it was under the old environment, but they're becoming visible to us. Individuals and business time horizons start to stretch again, growth resumes, and even if profitability in businesses is low, it starts to improve. So we now have stability and we have some degree of certainty, but it differs in a way that existed before the crisis. So what do you do to be successful in this phase? Well, you focus on reevaluating your customer experience strategy to win in the rules of the new normal situation. Typically, customer acquisition starts to lose ground to factors like retention and customer development as growth engines. In most businesses, customer acquisition is one of the biggest costs in the business, and it becomes more efficient to look at opportunities to both retain and develop existing customers. Perhaps more interestingly, portfolio thinking about the business becomes sharpened. Resources are going to prove much more scarce in this phase, so there's an expectation that you're going to want to do less overall in line with the reduction of resources, but also, quite possibly, you're expected to do more relative to the resources you have. In other words, become more efficient. Portfolio thinking works to address the first. Better selectivity around how to focus assets in the customer journey works to address the second. But first, I want to talk about the assumption that as the tide falls down, low NPS companies typically perform worse. You could see this potentially as an opportunity for NPS leaders in the space. You could think of this as a deficit that's being created by poor performing companies that will now perhaps come back to hurt them. Will low NPS companies suffer more? Well, yes, in all likelihood, but the answer can be complicated. The way to think about this in any industry is first of all to look at the degree of competition. If it's a highly uncompetitive industry, it's a limited monopoly or oligopolistic in its structure, then typically you see much less impact from NPS leadership. Secondly, what are the switching costs? Is your product and service so intrinsic to your customer that they're extremely unlikely to change simply because they don't like you anymore as a vendor? After those two factors are taken into consideration, the relative NPS in terms of industry performance will play out as customers, both consumers and B2B, start to basically make choices as to where they want to invest the more limited dollars they have. They're more likely to invest them in companies that they've established a very high level of loyalty to. So NPS plays out quite dramatically as you get past those other two factors. Having said all that, it's worth remembering probably the best quote I recall on this, which was from the then CEO of Virgin Media at the time, Neil Burkett, who'd just gone through one of the biggest CX transformations that we've ever seen in our 15 years of experience. Neil, as a leader, used to refer to customer loyalty as a shock absorber. And I think that's a great metaphor for understanding what NPS gives you. In the customers where you have high NPS, you're likely to have forgiveness. In the customers when you have low NPS, that shock absorber doesn't exist. The kinds of actions that you take now are going to be judged very harshly by those customers, but there's really no give. And that's something to consider when you look at your portfolio of customers. Before we get on to portfolio thinking, let's talk a bit about questions you might use to reevaluate your CX strategy. What is the growth strategy now for the business? So as you come into this new phase, where is the company going to be focused on achieving growth? Growth might be a lot harder to obtain than it was previously, so the company needs to be much more selective. How has the financial equation changed for NPS? Have the value of promoters and the value of detractors changed significantly? What are the new expectations of customers? Do you fully understand them and how they've changed? And how does that vary between different customer segments? How has your overall customer experience journey been impacted? Is it even the same journey anymore? Certainly, to the degree to which customers evaluate different components of the journey, there might be quite a considerable change. And overall, how do you take this situation and use it to maximize customer lifetime value or customer equity? For that, we'll just turn to a quick definition, and my favorite comes from Don Peppers, defining customer equity not just as the sum of lifetime values for existing customers, but the value of all additional customers the business will ever have in the future. Taken like this, you could argue that enterprise value for a company is very, very close to customer equity, but it's a quite a different way of thinking. So how do we apply lifetime value thinking to looking at cost constraints, choices we're going to make in this new normal? Well, there's a couple of frameworks we'd like to talk about very briefly. The first is a very familiar one for many of you, I'm sure, which is where you look at the Net Promoter Score, which is a good proxy for future LTV in many of your companies. This framework works like this. On one axis, you have the Net Promoter Score, which we're going to use as a proxy for the future lifetime value of the customer or customer equity, because there's highly likely to be a good correlation between these two things. On the other chart, we're going to look at profitability in the short term. As you evaluate customers, business segments, product lines, perhaps even geographies, you can start to plot them against this simple framework. In fact, many leadership teams do this as an ongoing basis. And what it reveals is you have certain customer groups that fall into a very attractive space with high future lifetime value and high degrees of short-term profitability. And you've got other customers that fall into less attractive spaces. The reality is, in a challenging economic environment, you're going to want to prioritize these groups of customers. Of course, one other overlay for this is growth opportunity. So it's important to understand that perhaps it's not just about where these customers are today, but where is the profitable growth opportunity in the future for your business? Where are the segments that are likely to see overall industry growth? Mapping these out and asking these questions enables you to make smarter choices. But there's another great framework which was developed by Das Nariandas at Harvard Business School. And he creates a loyalty ladder. We're not going to go into this now, but think of this as a series of steps of higher levels of loyalty. Not exactly the same as NPS, but it has some similarity. You can always look it up at a Harvard Business Review. And he maps that against the cost to serve. And that gives another view of the portfolio, in this context, business-to-business customers, and how you want to start thinking about treating these different groups of customers. The most interesting segment for me was always the high cost to serve, low loyalty customers. And Das rather whimsically often refers to those as strategic customers. The reason being because when you ever ask a company why on earth they continue to do business with these companies, their rationale is always, well, it must be something strategic. That's obviously a bit tongue in cheek. But again, any framework you can use to start to understand loyalty, lifetime value, cost to serve, and future growth potential gives you a more strategic context for making good business choices. By the way, in an environment where cost reduction seems to be very important, understanding cost to serve customers relative to their future potential, i.e. their NPS or lifetime value, seems like a really important analysis to do. The other thing to look at when we talk about smart cost reduction is to look once again to our old friend, the customer journey, and to understand how different events along the customer journey ultimately impact the lifetime value of the customer. It's simple to think of the customer journey events as constantly readjusting LTV outlook. Every time something occurs to a customer, their LTV essentially adjusts, their NPS adjusts, and the potential that they'll stay with you and do more business all changes. So understanding, as we typically do, how different elements of the journey impact NPS, understanding the degree to which they impact NPS and which ones you can affect seems very important, while recognizing that that situation is changing. And it also gives a good guidance as to where we can start to make cost reduction. If you link it to financial performance, you start to get great clarity about where the opportunities and risks are. Furthermore, if you can link it to the operational metrics and KPIs in your business, it starts to provide you with both good guidance for cost planning and execution of the business going forward. So the new mix becomes very apparent for success. At the end of the day, cost reduction can be smart. In many businesses, likely necessary. Scaling back operations could turn out to be inevitable, might even be desirable for many businesses, but the objective of any cost reduction should be to minimize the damage to customer LTV, or potentially even leave it at zero. You can do this in two real techniques, as we discussed. One is portfolio analysis of the business, and the other is looking at the overall journey performance, identifying operational performance elements that can inform the types of operational day-to-day choices that you want to make. So let's switch briefly to close the presentation with phase three, which is a letter to you from your future self. And this is just an interesting exercise to imagine what would you tell yourself when you look back on how you behaved and the steps you took at this time of crisis. Given that we all tend to become very short-term in thinking, it's a mental exercise to get us out of that natural way of approaching these problems. Well, looking back, I think we would recognize in all likelihood that these conditions in phase one, high volatility, did give way to some stability and a new normal. I think it's highly unlikely that customer experience suddenly went out of fashion and nobody cared anymore about whether they were delighting their customers. In fact, it's more likely that companies that best understood their customers and were able to act on that knowledge and make smart choices based on customer lifetime value analysis and understanding how to maximize it probably outperformed others who didn't. Those kind of smart strategic choices separated the winners out, focusing on the right segments and understanding how to create a differential customer experience in those segments. Thank you.